You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Gene Johnson, served as a career missionary for 16 years in Cambodia in the areas of pioneer church planting, on-the-job leadership training, and oral strategies. Presently, she is a missionary with World Mission Associates, promoting church sustainability and multiplication. Gene holds a BA in cross-cultural communications from North Central University, Minneapolis, Minnesota, where she also taught as a missionary in residence. Gene, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I heard you say one time that you really felt like missions found you instead of the other way around.
Yeah, so there were, you know, through seasons of life, there's different, always different refugee groups that are making their way to our shores. For me, it would be the United States. So when I was in high school, the refugee groups that were making their way to the United States were Southeast Asians. You had the Vietnamese who had the, of course, the war there. You had the Hmong who were experiencing troubles in Laos. And then you had the Cambodians who were escaping a genocide. So all those refugee groups eventually land in refugee camps, but then find their way to different countries to resettle. And when I was in high school, that's when my halls of my high school were suddenly filled with all three of those refugee groups, Cambodians, Hmong, and Vietnamese. So I was suddenly, as a kind of a middle-class, Midwestern, Anglo-Saxon person, was suddenly faced with groups of people that I knew nothing about, from a completely different culture, from animism to Buddhism, and different life experiences were there in my classroom, in my lunchroom. And Shane, at that time, I was just coming to know God in a personal sense and who he was, just beyond a religious, I have to go to church kind of thing with my parents. And so here are these people, cross-cultural, you know, communication. And instead of a lot of my classmates would ignore them or tease them because of the differences, but I was drawn to them. So I would eat lunch with them. I would sit down and say, could you tell me your story? Many of them struggled with speaking English, so I started a little English class. And that began my mission journey in the sense that it was my aha moment, like, wow, there's people out there that are different from me. And I started to ask that mission question, although at the time I didn't realize it was a mission question, but the question was, who brings the good news of Jesus to these people in a way that they can grasp it and understand and it's relevant? And so that was my strategic mission question, even though I didn't know it at the time, and it changed my life. Those relationships put me on a journey to be missional, which started with different people groups right there on my home front.
That kind of led you to put you on the road to write the book that we're here to talk about today, which is We're Not the Hero, A Missionary's Guide for Sharing Christ, Not a Culture of Dependency. You know, I confess my knowledge of recent Cambodian history was very lacking, but you lay it down really well in the book. It sounds like a lot of the problems of Cambodia in the 60s, 70s, and stretching on to today lie somewhat at the feet of America and the Vietnam War that America was fighting at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Vietnam overshadowed everything, the Vietnam War, and of course, it was intense for America and for those we sent there. But in a neighboring country of Cambodia, something incredibly awful was going on at the same time, which was overshadowed and affected by the Vietnam War, which most people don't know. But basically, it was Cambodians who had, in I think the 60s, had gone, traveled abroad and got in touch with some, through education, some of the communist philosophy, and decided that that's what Cambodia needed and came back to Cambodia and started to kind of cook their own recipe and brew of what that would look like in Cambodia. Unfortunately, that recipe was bizarre. It was out there. It was, unprecedented. It was actually Cambodians who decided they would do a cleansing, but not necessarily an ethnic cleansing of different groups, but it was Cambodians cleansing Cambodians. And basically what they did is they started out in the outskirts of the jungle and started to make their way little by little to the city center. But what they did there is to tell Cambodians out in the countryside that right now you should look at Cambodians is in two types of groups, the old Cambodians and the new Cambodians. Not by age, but old Cambodians were ones who, are farmers and they work with the land, and the new Cambodians were anybody who was modernized, who spoke another language, worked with as a civil servant, worked in the government, wore glasses, anything that was not the typical farmer. And they said, those are the new Cambodians and those are your enemies. And so they basically turn the entire country upside down. And, you hear of sending people to prison camps, but basically they turn the entire country into one, from west to east, north to south, into a labor-intensive camp where they reduce life to a bowl, spoon, and one pair of clothes, and everybody worked ungodly hours. And then they just started to basically torture and kill people systematically. So between 75 and 79, they killed approximately 3 million of their own people. And Shane, oddly enough, you brought up Vietnam. And the only thing that stopped this genocide was that Vietnam, the neighboring country, and they've been enemies for years, attacked Cambodia. So you had a war on top of genocide. And it was a blessing in disguise in the sense that as the Vietnam soldiers moved in, the Khmer Rouge, Khmer for Cambodian, Rouge for Red, the Cambodian Red Army, Khmer Rouge soldiers had to flee. And that's the first time Cambodians could begin to escape from this four-year torment. And Vietnam ended up not staying because they had no idea that the entire infrastructure was gone. Everything was gone. Anything that you would call society, anything modern, was absolutely wiped out. So Vietnam ended up pulling out. So that's Cambodia, a very sad story. And I, even to this day, this whole killing fields in Cambodia has not worked itself out of the people or their story. It'll take generations before that happens.
Many people listening like me may have heard of Pol Pot, but not really understood who he was or where he fit in. And, I kind of understood that he was a really bad guy, but he was the leader of that group that you were talking about. And he seemed intent on taking Cambodia back to the Stone Age for some reason. You mentioned that he just destroyed all the infrastructure. And it sounds like one of the first people groups that he chose to persecute and kill off were the intellectuals, the doctors, scientists, and I could just imagine that would really just do devastation on a country, even aside from the prison camps and the separation of families that took place after that.
Oh, absolutely. And, it's amazing because I, as you mentioned, I eventually went to Cambodia and spent 16 years of my life there, but I went to Cambodia in around 1992. And, you figure the genocide somewhat ceased in 79. So that's quite a span of time. But when I went there, you could still see the devastation because they killed the educated and ruined the infrastructure. There wasn't even a postal system there. I couldn't get mail. It had to be hand carried in, hardly any electricity, very few doctors, teachers, schools, education, just quite a mess, because you're right, they turned it back to what they call the year zero. So that means they ruined medicine, got rid of the market system, got rid of money, then destroyed the lawyers, the people who work on electricity and all those things. So you can't even imagine. And interesting enough, Shane, when, I mean, it seems hard to believe it, even as I talk about it, but why I was in Cambodia as a vocational missionary and / interpreter for the Ministry of Health, Pol Pot was alive, very well alive, and the Khmer Rouge would, for maybe the first 6 years I was there, tried to get back into power. He died while I was serving there. So, you know, that it seems like, well, that history should have, that, you know, awfulness should have ended somewhere sooner, but it carried on. And I think they had a tribunal just a year or so ago for some of the so-called murderers in that regime. So
that sets the stage, because you told the story about the Cambodian refugees coming to your high school. So that was about the time that people were able to get away. And so you were seeing that in your own high school in Minneapolis. Probably has something to say for us about refugees today and us taking them in as a country. And then you were having kind of, you were in the middle of your own life change with your experience with Christ. You became friends with the Cambodians at your school. A lot of other white kids were, would make fun of them, would, or at least just ignore them. But you were just curious about them. And eventually you began to live with a Cambodian family there.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. I kept those friendships from high school, kept those up for the most part. There was kind of a disconnect for a while. And then I reestablished those relationships while I was in college. And then God, as you said, missions came to me. I just kept moving, you know, into that role of wanting to be a cross-cultural communicator. So when I graduated from college, I really wanted to go to Cambodia. That was my desire. But it was a closed country. As I just described, you couldn't just like show up in Cambodia as a missionary. So that's when I felt like God put on my heart, it's not about a place, it's about people. And why wouldn't I just start serving as a cross-cultural communicator in the name of Jesus right there in my own town, my own city? So that's what I did. So about a week after graduating from college, I found a Cambodian family of 8 members living in a upper duplex, 1-bedroom, quite crowded already. They had beds in the kitchen, and asked if I could move in. I wanted to learn to serve this people group by being as much of an insider as possible, in the sense of plopping myself in their daily lives, figuring out what would it be like to be a refugee family, trying to settle where the husband, the head of the household, had been killed during the Khmer Rouge genocide, learn the language, learn the culture. So I did life with them as a nucleus, as a family, and then I eventually moved into an apartment building a few blocks away in the inner city of Minneapolis, where there were 30 Cambodian families. My approach was what we might term incarnational, in the sense that I moved in, lived as, you know, I just took on an income that was about at their level, lived with them, did life with them as well. It was like a, because we were in a cold weather society, it was like an indoor village. The hallways, we did a lot of life out in the hallways. And I did that for 6 years. And of course, sharing Christ, making disciples, and all those things.
Let's speed up to your time in Cambodia, because I want to get to the heart of the book. And I wish people listening, go buy the book, but also just go look and see the cover of it, because it really sets the tone. The cover of the book shows like the bottom half of man's legs, and he's wearing socks that look like the American flag with cowboy boots over them. And that really speaks a lot to the message of the book. I wonder, Gene, what your attitude was when you went over to Cambodia. It sounds like undoubtedly you had wonderful intentions, but I get the feeling you didn't have the perspective that you have now about missions.
Yeah, I mean, I did and I didn't, and some of the perspective I had while living in Minneapolis, that sort of incarnational intentionality, got sort of lost or confused when I went to Cambodia, and so I had to kind of work my way back to it in many ways. But yeah, I think with me personally, I had wanted to go to Cambodia so long and so bad that I had built up this passion and this energy that I've got to get there, I've got to get there. So after living with Cambodians for 6 years, in 1992, the door opened for me to go there. And in my book, I talk about my greatest asset became my greatest stumbling block. And what I mean by that is my greatest asset is that when I arrived in Cambodia, I already spoke the language. I knew quite a bit of the culture. So what an asset. I mean, who doesn't want to know a language when they already arrive in their place of service? But where it became a stumbling block is that because I already knew the language and I was so driven to accomplish, to you know, expediency and to produce fruit, I jumped right into planting a church within about a month within the country. And so why that became my stumbling block is because I instantly started operating out of kind of defaulted back to my own worldview. So whatever my church experience was in America, whatever kind of standard of living or economic provision I could bring to the church or to church planting, that's how I conceptualized and organized the mission task. So yeah, it worked. Things happened, church was planted, those kind of things. But with that kind of hero mentality that I've arrived and, you know, you've been waiting for me and, you know, I'm here, I am the missionary and I'm going to make things happen for God. That's the passion and the drive, but that passion lacked wisdom and discernment. And a lot of people ask me if I had a, you know, start all over, did it all over again, what would I do differently? And that would be that even though I knew the language and some of the culture, I would have not done anything formal whatsoever in regard to what we call mission or ministry for at least 2 years. I would have spent those 2 years just getting to know people, getting to know the worldview, getting to know the treasures of the worldview, getting to know what's already happening there. Yeah, so we are not the hero. A lot of us go as Westerners. When you put the word mission and poverty together, it can be a very dangerous, misleading combination of words, because when you leave your country to go to serve as a missionary and you have it in your mind that they're poor and you're going to, you know, fix their poverty, we tend to operate out of the we are not the hero mentality, which leads to dozens and dozens of unintended consequences that don't show up until way later.
So I think there's that kind of person that you just talked about, who's kind of oblivious to this and does see themselves as the hero. And then I think that there's another side that, especially people of my generation who have seen the damage done by missionaries, who've seen colonization, and just conclude that we just shouldn't do missions then, or that it's just dirty work, which I think is equally as sad.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think I use the word passion to marry with wisdom. Wisdom without passion, wisdom without lack of desire to go and to be and to serve is no better off than the other way around. I think what we do is we tend to do one or the other, as you mentioned, and not marry the two. So I don't think the question is, should we go, should we serve, should we love, should we be for others on behalf of others? That's not the question whatsoever. I think it's if we and when we go and we're sent and we stay, what should our posture be like? What should our attitude be like? What should our strategies and models be like? I think that's the question we got to keep answering. And in order to answer that, you know, I think, I don't, you didn't use the term, but I think there's, you know, I'm going to throw it out, being ethical. I think we need to return to ethics in our cross-cultural mission. And what I mean by that is what I feel like's happened as an overreaction to, or what's happening kind of with the contemporary day that we find ourselves in, is that somehow we've concluded that we don't, okay, here's the word I'm looking for, globalization. Because of globalization, we have stopped doing the cross-cultural work. And we put the cross-cultural work on the shoulders of the people we go to. In other words, if you just, even today, 20, 30-year-olds, when you look around to see what they're doing cross-culturally, it's teaching English, you know, opening coffee houses, of course, justice and all of those things. But the thing with that is it's still us going to places, doing things that are from our worldview, doing things that we love, doing things that are comfortable for us, and then inviting people to come to us, come into our comfort zone, you know, learn English in order to know Christ. So I think it really comes down to how do we go? What are our attitudes? What are our postures? And my call would be to every generation, especially the younger generation, don't allow globalization to fool us into the fact that everybody's just like us. Everybody loves us. Everybody loves our language. So therefore, use all of those mechanisms. I would still suggest that we go as the learner and we put the cross-cultural burden back on our shoulders, which means sitting down and having tea with a family day after day after day, listening, so that when we do open our mouths, we're speaking to their heart and their soul, not just their intellect or their desire to be like us somehow in America.
I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of missionaries going and really just trying to turn the people they're ministering to into Westerners. It's a fairly known phenomenon of in the past Christian missionaries going to tribes that didn't wear clothes and trying to make them wear clothes. Even I've heard of missionaries who went to places where men had multiple wives and then telling them that they had to divorce one or more so that they only had one wife. And so the Christians there were known for divorce at the time. For the record, I think Christians should only marry once, but once it's done in another culture.
It's more complex.
Yeah, that's a lot of pastoral guidance that needs to happen there in that context. And I just wonder if you saw on the mission field or even participated in it, trying to teach people things that people felt like was just Christianity, but really those were an American expression of Christianity, or maybe it was just some kind of Westernism.
Well, you know, there's that saying that fish can't describe water. They're just too close to it. And I think that's what happens with Westerners that go to cultures that are maybe folk Buddhist, Spiritism, Hinduism, etc. And I think the biggest challenge that we have is that we ourselves don't know what is culture and what is gospel. We don't know what has co-opted our faith. And so when we go and we bring the gospel, we assume we're bringing the gospel unadulterated, but chances are tons of it is co-opted, you know, or integrated with our faith and culture, and we're not really bringing the gospel as much as we think we are. And I wish I could say that all those colonialistic sort of paternalistic examples you brought up are in the past. Now, those particular ones may be in the past, but what I see now, even in 2017 going into 2018, I see different forms of the Western church being transplanted or causing other people to commit cultural suicide. And you ask, what are some of those modern day examples? I mean, the greatest one that comes to mind is that, you know, just even styles of worship or the way people sit. I can give you two examples, one from my book of my own personal experience and one that I've been thinking about as of late. In the book, I talk about where I go to a church actually that I had started in the capital city, went to just visit, see how the Cambodians there were doing. And they were worshiping, just the typical kind of way that you'll probably see in many churches around the world. And I was worshiping with them, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw a Cambodian man who was doing something oddly. I couldn't get my head around it, so I kept straining to look at him. What is he doing? Why is he acting like that? And it dawned on me that this Cambodian man was blind. And I realized, wow, what he's doing, because he can't see everybody else worship, he's worshiping exactly how a Cambodian would worship, from the innate, most heartfelt way a Cambodian would, which is how they would greet a king or somebody important coming into their village, which meant his shoes were off, he was not quite prostrate, but he was bowed low. He was not making eye contact with God, because in Cambodian culture, if you make eye contact, that's disrespectful. And so that's what a Cambodian should look like when they're worshiping, because there was nothing to inform him of how worship should look except the Bible itself. So based on what he was learning in the Bible and who he was as a Cambodian, that was worship for him. But as you looked around the rest of the room, people were standing, they were lifting their hands, they were making eye contact, they were noisy and loud, you know, kind of the typical American worship service. And so that's just one example of bringing the gospel and bringing our modes and forms and styles, and not separating the two, just passing them both on. Now think about it, Shane, if a Cambodian is a Buddhist for 200 years, meaning their grandparents and their grandparents, and they hear about Jesus and the gospel for the first time, but at that same time, we're modeling worship, we're modeling prayer and the different forms of the function, how is a Cambodian going to sit back, never cracking a Bible, knows nothing, and is supposed to sort out and say, oh, what the missionary's doing there is, that's their culture, but this is the Bible stuff, and so we'll do this and not do that. They tend to imitate everything we do, which brings me to the other example. So, and a lot of people who do like community development these days and justice kind of get the sense, because they're doing justice or they're doing development, that somehow they're above this kind of neo-colonialism, or that they're not really passing on the worldview. But this would be an example of fish doesn't really know water. So in places like Cambodia, and probably 70% of the world, they're communal people, they're collective people. And we come from very highly individualistic society. So think about Cambodia. The average village has one pagoda, or what you might call a temple, per village. And when people gather for social religious activities, they all go to that one pagoda. It's unheard of to have two pagodas in one village. And yet, when we come with the gospel in the name of Jesus, or so-called Christianity, we come, and then the Baptists say, well, you need a church building here in this village. But then the Methodists come, and they want a church building. And then you know, the next group comes, and the next group comes. And before you know it, in one village or area, there might be 12 different Christian churches based on denomination. What does that do to communal culture? The Cambodians are sitting back thinking, what's wrong with you people? You know, you have one God, but you have all of these, you know, you extract and set up an individualism in the church buildings and competition. So that would be one modern day example as well of how we continue to bring our culture with the gospel.
The idea of dependency is something that you talk a lot about in the book. I was really fascinated to learn about Cambodia's history, where it sounds like around the 1920s, there was a fairly successful but modest missionary work going on there. And there was kind of a thriving Christian community, but the missionaries basically waited entirely too long to try to make the Christians in Cambodia self-sufficient. And it wasn't until, I think, about the 1960s till they started pushing for that self-sufficiency. And it was just kind of a little bit too little too late by that point.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, unhealthy dependency is something you're conditioned into. It's not necessarily, it's human nature. So if somebody continues to, I mean, help you, does something for you or gives you something the first time, you know, you're kind of, oh, this is cool, this is exciting. But when you start to kind of give one way, one direction to the same group or the same person over and over, it can very quickly become entitlement and, you know, I expect this, and it just doesn't take long whatsoever. And so in that case, they realized, wow, without us, if we were to leave or walk away from supporting what we set up here in Cambodia in the 20s and 30s, it would collapse. So they decided to do something different. So they made the decision to begin to wean away from subsidizing Christianity, so to speak, in Cambodia. But that led to all kinds of problems, and they lost all kinds of people. So it really was kind of a test of the depth and width of what they were doing there. Cool thing is that I write in the book that they were left with about 300 Christians who said, well, whether you pay us or not, we're going to stick with this, maybe 300 out of 2,000 or so, which is the exact amount of those left over in, Gideon's army.
Oh, that's right.
God asked them to wean away from, you know, however they drank the water. There was 300 left. That was sort of a test who psychologically, emotionally, spiritually really owns this Christian faith and experience. Who would go on with it? Who would do it, whether they're paid or not, from the outside? And so then that 300 really began to grow like crazy. But then that's when the genocide happened. So that's one historical example of where unhealthy dependency was spotted by those missionaries. They started to deal with it. The results were much better once they dealt with it, but then the genocide interrupted that. And so then you have the next wave of missionaries coming post-genocide, which includes myself and those who came. And we kind of just ignored, or maybe didn't know about, or didn't take time to get to know about that story called The Thinning, or it's in a book called, I think, Living Fields, Killing Fields, or the other way around. So we just, you know, kind of did the same thing. And we talked earlier, Shang, about forms and models of mission. If you go to a country and you use forms from your culture that particular people group can't pay for, can't improvise for, then yes, you end up paying for it. You have to. And if you pay for it in their early days of Christianity, or their early days of getting to know the gospel or becoming disciples of Jesus Christ, that's the message you tell them. You tell them that, hey, we brought the gospel, we've brought all things mission. Oh, and by the way, we pay for it. And then they learn, oh yeah, that's how it works. You pay for it. You sustain it. And so by the time you're done and you stop to breathe, you realize, wow, we've just created this codependency. Everything we've set up here in this country, for the most part, is indispensable to us. And the reason I became so aware myself is because there was a coup in 1997 where all the missionary personnel, foreign personnel, were evacuated. And suddenly everything we set up as missionaries and were subsidizing, we were gone. And it was a wake-up call, at least to me, that, you know, we can't bring the gospel and make it dependent on us, or we'll always be the ones who own it. We'll always be the foreigners set it up. We start it, we launch it, we pay for it, we own it. And there comes colonialism in a neo-colonialism 2017 version of it.
I wonder how we can learn to delegate. That kind of seems like the word that we're walking around here, essentially letting others, letting locals do the things when it might be easier, at least in the short term, to just do it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that plays into it. You know, as anybody, when we do something, our identity is wrapped in it. So when we start something and launch it, we want it to go well. And then we conclude, well, for it to go well, then it's better. I'm better off to do it. Or there's something in my book I write about the difference between functional ownership and psychological ownership, which I learned from Glenn Schwartz, who has written a book, When Charity Destroys Dignity. But functional ownership is where I go as an outsider. I come in, I have a vision for ministry or whatever, and I start it and I launch it. And then I find Cambodians and I say, hey, you want to join my vision? This is what it would look like. And I would even delegate and say, well, you could do this, you could do that. But I'm still paying them. So they're joining me, yes, but they're joining me based on functional ownership. In other words, if the money's not there or they get a better offer, they're going to move on to the next thing. What we often skip, the step that we skip is not even, you know, delegation, yes, but even going back further to a more foundational principle is that psychological ownership. Where does psychological ownership come from? It comes from the Cambodians saying from the very beginning, what do we want to do? What's going to work for us? What will that look like for our culture? What will it cost us? What will we have to sacrifice? Who will it involve? And that psychological ownership is then there because they're birthing the vision. And then in that vision, they start paying for it. They start sacrificing for it, and it's theirs. Well, we tend to have something that's ours, and then we want to pass it on or invite them into what's ours. I think the challenge of being a missionary or a Christian cross-cultural workers, how do we start from the beginning where they believe it's theirs and they feel it's theirs? It's a different role. It's a difference between setting something up we want to do, inviting them in, which is functional ownership, or going there without an agenda other than the gospel itself and love thy neighbor as thyself and love God with all your heart, soul, and might, inviting them into that equation and then saying to them, now, how will this play out in your communities, in your neighborhoods, and what will it look like both gospel-wise and Cambodian-wise? We skip those beginning steps, and then that's when we end up with something that's, you know, I go to Steve's church, or I work for, you know, World Vision, or I work for this ministry or that ministry, rather than this is ours, and we're going to pray for this, and we're going to die for this, and we're going to give for this.
I think there are going to be a lot of people who are listening who like what you're saying, but they're not career missionaries. And I wonder what advice you would give for those of us who are here on the home front, and maybe we're supporting other ministries monetarily or with our time, and just what you would say to them about how they should proceed and maybe evaluate organizations that they give to or support in other ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much going on in missions, and there's so many groups and potential places you could give money to and share your gifts with. That's a tough question. I think you kind of need to go back to research a bit what their philosophy is and what their model is, and, you know, ask the questions. Are they thinking themselves of the long term? You kind of got to do your homework. It's almost like just because we're supporters doesn't excuse us from learning. Because, well, I'm giving it to such and such an organization, you know, who should I trust? Well, it goes back to even a more strategic question. What do you understand and know of missions yourself? And it might be you educating yourself and not necessarily trying to find the best organization out there. Like, you know, people ask me, could I give them a list? Well, I don't want to give you a list. I want to give you the capacity to think wisely and understand things. So books like Toxic Charity or When Helping Hurts, We Are Not the Hero. You know, and there's a lot of great books right now, like on the disciple-making movements, where things are working because the movement mentality is more grassroots. It is reproducible. Multiplication is built in. I think getting their heads around some of those and read and become educated, then when it's time to give, you'll have a better sense of where and who to give to. Yeah, so that's kind of my... You know, I think it's good that we spend time discipling ourselves in regard to mission and cross-cultural work. I don't know if I've answered your question, but you can let me know.
No, that's great. And I think those are great resources. We've had Brian Fickert has been on the show before, who wrote When Helping Hurts that you mentioned. And you mentioned Bob Lupton's books, Toxic Charity. Those are great, great resources. My friend Chris Marlowe wrote a book called Doing Good is Simple. I think that's the name of it. And we've got interviews actually with those people here. So check those out, and then those books as well for those people who are listening. Gene, I mentioned in the beginning that you're a missionary with World Mission Associates, which has been changed. The name has changed to Five Stones Global. And you're actually, I don't know your exact title, you're the president of it, I think. The executive director, there you go.
Yeah,
so tell us a little bit about Five Stones Global.
Yeah, Five Stones Global, the nature of who we are, our personality is embedded in that exact term, Five Stones Global. And it takes us back to that famous Bible story of David and Saul and Goliath. David and Saul are of different cultures. Saul is a king. He lives in a king's realm. He's used to king's things. And David's a shepherd, and he's used to sheep in that culture. Well, David had a vision to take on the obnoxious giant that was persecuting the Israelites. And David brought that vision to Saul, and Saul, the leader that he was, the first thing that came to his mind was, you're not capable, you're too young, you don't have enough experience. And then David's like, hey, wait a minute, I have experience. I may not be a king, but as a shepherd, God has done many things to help me fight lions and tigers and bears, so to speak. And so Saul eventually says, okay, fine, I see you have vision, but let me give you my model, let me give you my forms. And so Saul begins to take off all his king-like gear, his heavy armor, all those things, and downloads it onto David. And David starts to try to go in it, and he says to King Saul, he says, hey, I can't go in these. I'm not used to them. And thankfully, David had enough sense to know an identity and, you know, a healthy self-image, that he took off all of that king's armor and went and got what made sense to him as a shepherd, according to his culture and his organic nature, and got five smooth stones out of the stream and took on the giant. And Five Stones Global chose this name because we parallel missions in a way to this story. Often as Westerners coming into countries, we want to unload and download and transplant our forms and things that we're used to in our culture. And the people around the world are putting it on, and they're going about, and some of them are strapped in it and don't even bother to take it off because they don't know they even have permission to do that or freedom to do that. But the idea is that they're going around in inherited models and formats of Christianity that are not necessarily even in the Bible, and they're saying, we can't go to these, we are not used to them. So what Five Stones Global does is come alongside the global community to help them create a culture of dignity, sustainability, and multiplication. In other words, how do we approach missions where we're all starting not off of, well, you can't do it. You're an inexperienced here. This is how you do it. Here's the way I do it. And rather ask them from the get-go, what are their assets? You know, what would work for you, and help them find whatever their five smooth stones would be for them. So that's who we are. We're made up of seasoned missionaries who all have come to the conclusion that mission in some ways is broken, and that we don't want people to cultivate a culture of unhealthy dependency, but rather dignity, sustainability, and multiplication. So we equip, teach, train, speak, and do whatever we can to breathe and speak into that culture, that context. And I don't know, Shane, I'd love to tell you too that we are not the hero book. We're in the throes of creating a participant's guide, because people have come to us and said, oh, we wish there was a participant's guide. So that's what we're doing. It's going to be a digital, virtual, highly interactive, colorful, fun, and also videos to go with it. And that will come out in January. And you'll be able to find that on our website, fivestonesglobal.org.
Wow, that's so cool. Well, obviously, for those listening, we'll have a link to that on the show notes here so people can follow up and, of course, get the book. As we were talking, I was just remembering, and I would be remiss, just since we mentioned those other books, one of my favorite in this vein is by Leroy Barber, and it's called Red, Brown, Yellow, Black, White, Who's More Precious in God's Sight? And it's about diversity in Christian missions, but it also talks about missions here at home, and especially going into the inner city when people try to do good, and there's so much that gets so complicated. His book was really good about talking about that. I don't know if you've heard that one, Gene. It's fantastic, and talks about finding the people in the neighborhood who already exist and supporting them. So it seems really in line with what your message is here. Well, Gene, it's been so good to talk to you. Thanks for being on Seminary Dropout today.
Well, Shane, it was my joy and great to talk with you, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah.